Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
My guest today on the Gillette Health Podcast is Dr. Nick Norwitz, a PhD and medical student that has been making the rounds with his diet and study that we've mentioned multiple times, the Oreo diet, which of course he only did as a temporary case study. But he is already one of the most recognizable advocates for understanding the lean mass hyperresponder. And I don't know if I would go so far as to say he's misunderstood, but I think that he shares the same passion that James O'Hara and myself do, in that he just wants the data to be out there and the data to be published for groups of areas of health that he shares the concern for. So people with inflammatory bowel disease, people with muscle wasting, people with that want to improve their bone density or their body composition or their body fat percentage or their athletic performance. And yes, of course, people who are worried about their ApoB levels and their cardiovascular disease risk, and that may be on a low-carb or ketogenic diet for another reason, for example, epilepsy. So please listen in and enjoy the conversation that I had with Nick. Nick, it's been great getting to know you recently, and it's a pleasure to have you on, I suppose, an episode of the mini podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I know that we've talked about a lot of the various research articles you've been involved with, and I've mentioned the Metabolic Health Summit, which we both spoke at recently, but I know we've gotten a lot of comments about the lean mass hyperresponder. We've kind of done some preliminary podcasts about that. But I guess as someone who's already a scientist, but also a medical doctor in training, how did you get yourself in this spot so early in life? How did you get here?
Well, my metabolic health journey began, I think, like a lot of people's, with a personal, I'm going to say the word catastrophe, and then I realized I might be hyperbolic, but honestly, it was a catastrophe, so I'm going to stick with that word. I was finishing up college. I went to Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, and was about to embark on medical school at Harvard Medical School. And at the same time, I'd gotten a fellowship to go do a PhD in the UK. So I was just kind of finishing up my undergraduate degree and looking towards my future. But around that point in time, it was my very early 20s, I started having GI issues. And for some context, like, I had never really had severe health problems and never had any food restrictions. I was the kind of person who's, you know, all my friends' moms loved me because they'd always have three servings of whatever they were serving. And really loved to go around and explore food. And I also just loved to cook. Like, I had a baking club that I started. I really was just a big foodie. So, you know, having a conflict with food was a social problem for me. I don't know why I'm even talking about that. Point being, I developed ulcerative colitis, and it just got worse and worse, such that when I, after finishing graduate school and going to the UK to do my PhD, ended up in the ICU and even palliative care for a little while with these severe flares. And I couldn't eat anything or couldn't keep anything in me. I lost about 20% of my body weight, was very sick, very emaciated, and had gone to a place, you know, or let's say from a place where I was, I wouldn't say an elite athlete, but I was pretty fit. Like, I could run a sub-3 marathon, was working out several hours a day on the triathlon team, to, you know, being, you know, let's just say getting out of bed and walking to the lab was my exercise. I was completely depleted, and nothing I was trying was really helping. Until then, out of desperation and not expectation, I started to fiddle with different lifestyle interventions. And then I kind of went through the whole list of diets, the standard ones you do first for IBD, the ones the doctors tell you have maybe a little bit of impact and evidence base. For those just listening, I'm putting quotes in the air, and we can talk about why I'm putting quotes in the air later. But none of those helped. And eventually, I got so desperate, I tried a ketogenic diet. This was June 1st, 2019. And to my surprise, I started feeling better almost immediately. And my inflammatory markers dropped. And years later, I'm now in biopsy-proven remission off of all medications for inflammatory bowel disease. And it really gave me my life back and my future back. And I think I can say that non-hyperbolically. I was in a place where I thought I might have to drop out of school, couldn't finish my PhD, let alone go to med school. And, you know, and then it's something that definitely has an impact on you as an individual. But I'm by nature very skeptical. So this wasn't the moment of, you're probably thinking now, oh, he had a personal experience and then became, you know, a keto evangelical. Not how it went down. I figured I had a unicorn response that, like, I don't know what's going on. I'm happy it happened, but like, this isn't typical. It's not something I read about in the literature. So I'm going to be extremely skeptical. But it was enough of a catalyst to get me interested in some of the literature, a lot of it being basic science, just because the clinical trials are very limited, and also in the community spaces. And what I started to notice was this motif. And now I say again and again, the most remarkable thing about my story is that it wasn't unique at all. You see this again and again, where people struggle with conventional Western medicine, quote, evidence-based medicine, and then become desperate and try something a little bit out of the box with respect to their lifestyle. I see it often be carbohydrate restriction and ketogenic diets, and then they have this life-changing experience. And then they're like, well, why didn't I try this 2, 5, 10 years ago? And then they just want to, you know, share their personal experience. Now, I'm in a little bit of a different boat because for me, I do share my personal experience because I think it allows people to connect with me, but I'm less interested in that than using the platform I have now and, you know, my career trajectory to actually changing things from within the system. I can conduct the science. I can practice the clinical medicine, or at least I will be able to shortly. So I feel in a little bit of a privileged position, having had that patient experience, now being a PhD scientist and being a young clinician in training to, let's say, operate on a lot of different fronts to, and then here's my tagline, here's my mission, make metabolic health mainstream. I think kind of we probably share that mission. So that's how I got into
Definitely.
this space. As for the whole lean mass hyperresponder thing, that was something that I noticed incidentally in myself, like many others do. When you go keto for a therapeutic reason, there's a subset of people who see their cholesterol spike. And being someone who was medically informed by the point that this happened to me, I knew what an LDL level of 300, 400, 500 meant. And, you know, my eyes like bugged out, my eyebrows shot through the roof when I saw these levels, because these are the kind of things you hear about as like, this is only in rare genetic conditions. You know, homozygous familial hypercholesterolemia, if you have an LDL of 545, which is where mine eventually got to. So it's like scary from a patient perspective because this isn't something that you really, you know, can wrap your head around the consequences of that. I'm like, I'm in my 20s. I don't want to die of heart disease by age 30. But at the same time, from a scientific perspective, it's fascinating because it doesn't fit with any phenotype we've ever seen before. It just doesn't. And so you want to start to unravel it for personal selfish reasons, because I don't want to die, but also from a scientific perspective, because it's just so fascinating. By the end of this conversation, I hope those listening will understand why I find this so fascinating.
For sure. No, I think that's definitely two good reasons. And at some point, I'm sure you thought to yourself, there's an awful lot of anecdotes. Well, yes, of lean mass hyperresponders, but that's all also, pretty commonly written about in the clinical literature, but specifically of people on ketogenic diets or even carnivore diets that have inflammatory bowel disease. There's an awful lot of anecdotes of that helping that kind of lean IBD phenotype.
Yeah. Well, I'll use that moment to elaborate on the air quotes I threw in the air before. Because when I went IBD, remember I said I use some diets that some doctors will say maybe will help a little bit, specific carbohydrate and low FODMAP. And what you'll probably hear if you have IBD or you go to a clinic with someone with IBD and they go to the doctor is they'll say something along the lines of diet doesn't help in IBD, but these diets might help control symptoms. You might hear something like that. And that's incorrect. That is factually incorrect, and I'll tell you why. Because the statement diet doesn't help in IBD is not the same as the statement we don't have strong data that diet can help in IBD. That gets to the point of absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence. And so when you hear these stories, these quote anecdotes, which in, science is supposed to be a dirty word, but I don't think it's a dirty word, of people going into remission on ketogenic and carnivore diets, which now I see a ton of, and actually we have a patient case series in the works right now because we have to start with a case series before we can get funding for, a major trial, but we do want to do a randomized controlled trial. It's what we have because the actual studies haven't been done. We haven't actually rigorously asked the question and found no results. It's just now an unknown that is now being, it can only be informed by anecdotes. So when you hear someone have a life-changing experience like I did, and many other people did, you can't just wave your hands and say they're anecdotes and diet doesn't help in IBD when the question's never been properly asked, and the question's never been properly asked because it's very hard to do because of the research infrastructure we have. Nobody is paid to do that trial. It's very easy to pay to do a trial for, a biologic because if it works, the pharma company is going to make a lot of money. Nobody's going to make a lot of money on a ketogenic or carnivore diet. So it's a harder, our research infrastructure isn't built to support dietary trials, leading to a lack of investigation, which gets confused with there's negative evidence, if that makes sense.
That's another thing that we frequently harp on in any functional medicine or basically a clinic that considers things that are still evidence-based. It's still evidence-based to operate out of the pyramid of evidence-based medicine that's below systematic reviews and meta-analyses. So what if you don't have something, if you have a decision tree, you're going down the dichotomy or whatnot, and there's nothing to go by at the top, or you've already been on those medications or interventions and they've failed, or they had a suboptimal response, then you go down the tree of evidence-based medicine all the way down. So that's something that I remind people is it is still evidence-based medicine. It's just at a different point of the pyramid.
Yeah, but you have to set up, you can't have one pyramid for a disease circumstance and operate off that pyramid. You need parallel pyramids. So you can have the pharma pyramid and you can have the lifestyle pyramid because different interventions come with different risks and benefits. So if someone doesn't want to go on a corticosteroid, in cycles and they keep on flaring up, do you just try a new biologic, which could suppress your immune system? I mean, what biologics do is a TNF-alpha inhibitor. Or do you say, I don't have an RCT for a ketogenic diet, but what is the cost of trying it, even when you have to go down that separate lifestyle pyramid quite a ways to develop a rationale? You could go down to anecdotes, but you could also parallel that because you could think of the pyramid more as like, there are pillars. You have clinical anecdotes, and then you also have biological plausibility. So there are now data that beta-hydroxybutyrate levels in the GI system correlate negatively with IBD activity, and other studies showing that, say, for carnivore diet, fiber elimination in parallel with enteral nutrition can actually change the, position of certain pathobionts in the microbiome to induce remission. It's actually very common to use fiber-free enteral nutrition to put refractory Crohn's disease into remission. So you can kind of piece the puzzle together based on biological plausibility, clinical anecdotes, things way below the level of randomized controlled trial to build a rationale for trying it on an individual use basis. But eventually what, we have to do, you and me in the scientific community, the biomedical scientific community, is somehow find a way to develop the quote rigorous studies that will allow it to be mainstream. Because right now you have practitioners that will say, well, why don't you try a ketogenic diet for a little while and then coach a patient through that? But it's not going to become mainstream until we do have the superpowered RCT.
That's a good way to look at it. And sometimes James and myself joke when we're talking about supplements versus medications or diet versus medications. Mm-hmm. It's like the astronaut that I forget exactly how the meme goes, but they've always been the same, right? Because, you know, even if you look at things in the diet, you look at what the molecular changes are downstream to that. That's really kind of looking at pharmacodynamics and how your body processes it. You're really kind of looking at pharmacokinetics. So I think it's kind of ridiculous that people still argue that food isn't medicine or whatnot. But I think that's a great way to look at it. And that process of discussing the risks, which is shared decision-making, is difficult to do if the clinician is not aware of the risks. So that's one thing that we definitely have in common. You mentioned that the LMHR phenotype, which I've mentioned, I'm kind of on that phenotype, if I'm not taking ezetimibe, as something that you kind of came about incidentally. I know when I look at my labs, if there's anything off, I kind of jump a little bit and get a little bit, I don't feel stressed from it, but I feel like I have to understand this and I have to change it. That's why my wife calls me the world's biggest hypochondriac. But from finding that incidentally and looking into it more, what have you noticed as someone who I guess has a personal and academic interest in that? What have you noticed as far as like the conventional medicine or academia responding well to that or not responding well to that?
Yeah, I mean, when it's just talked about secondhand, I'll tell you, even as someone who's relatively credentialed, it's such a bizarre thing in medicine that if someone doesn't have the PubMed IDs in front of them and is having their face shoved into them, they won't believe you. Like I've mentioned before, we have this patient with an LDL of 600. They're like, this must just be a confused medical student. There's no way. No way. I've tried to think of a good analogy to explain how bizarre this is to people, but I guess I put it like this. Imagine you're, in a food court or any public area, and you see people kind of walking in and out. And then you just see someone walk in who's 9 feet tall. Like, that's what a lean mass hyperresponder is. It is the most bizarre thing. But now pause and think, okay, what if after that 9 foot tall person, you look at them and your eyes like bug out, but then just 12 more 9 foot tall people walk in. So it's not just a single outlier, but it's actually starting to develop a pattern. Like, this is something that stands out and is weird. And the lipid phenotype of lean mass hyperresponders is weird for anybody that's looked at lipids. To have an LDL over 200, an HDL over 80, and a triglyceride of under 70, that union of markers is extremely rare at a population level,
yep,
given that the population is mostly mixed diet. But it's actually not that rare when you start to dig into ketogenic populations who are lean. Then it becomes very common. So it's like, imagine if you found an island where all the people were 9 feet tall, like human beings 9 feet tall. You just very clearly conclude that this is a unique population. There's something different about them. And then the question becomes, well, what is different about them and what is driving this phenotype? And the very interesting, well, there are a lot of interesting things about lean mass hyperresponders, but the interesting thing that I guess I would use to differentiate it from other lipid phenotypes is if you go to your standard clinician and talk to them about cholesterol levels, they'll think that they move glacially slow and that they're probably set largely from birth. If your levels are super high, so if you walk in and you have an LDL that's above 200, let alone above 500, like mine has been, they'll just assume you have a genetic defect. You must have FH. There is no other possibility in the literature to their minds. But that's not the case here. That's not the case here because a lot of it, well, LMHR is almost, they have normal LDL at baseline almost by definition. So my baseline LDL on a mixed diet, and when I say mixed, I mean Western diet, mm-hmm, was 90s, right? And then it goes into the 500s. But that's not even the weirdest thing. The weirdest thing are the levers that push it there. Mm-hmm. So the standard thing we think about, okay, aside from genetics, is things like saturated fat.
Yep.
Saturated fat has very little impact on my LDL. In fact, my LDL peak of 545 milligrams per deciliter occurred when I was eating very low cholesterol, and a 1 to 5.67 gram ratio of saturated to unsaturated fat. So for every 1 gram of saturated fat, 1.567 grams of unsaturated fat. That means my fat profile was 15% saturated, 85% unsaturated, which is like, you know, the saturated, unsaturated fat roughly of olive oil. I was not guzzling butter, and my cholesterol intake was very low. I'll explain why it was low in a sec. Other levers that push my LDL up is if I'm more active and if I'm leaner, so if I lose body fat. So how do you explain this phenotype whereby LDL shoots through the roof with carbohydrate restriction, but it's not really driven by saturated fat? In fact, it can occur even in like zero cholesterol vegan ketogenic context, and then it goes up further with exercise and the leaner you get. And it occurs as part of a triad with also very, very high HDL and low triglycerides. So this isn't just a matter of let's try to explain the high LDL. You have to explain all those things, including like a dose response relationship whereby the lower the BMI goes, the higher the LDL goes. And now we've shown that in, we were talking about the hierarchy of evidence, we now have a meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials. So it doesn't get higher than that. So there's clearly a bona fide phenotype here, something going on.
Yep.
And it's only just emerged into the literature within the last couple of years. And so it's something we're exploring, and it's something I'm incredibly excited about because, you know, in these outliers, I think there is so much to learn about physiology. When you start to try to build models to explain the phenotype and then test those models rigorously, you end up with these bizarre, bizarre phenomena that are consistent with the physiology that you can predict. Hence the, and I'm sure we get into it, like Oreo versus statin study, where I lowered my cholesterol with Oreo cookies. It sounds like a joke. Currently the title, I'm always changing the title, but of the video abstract is, this is not a joke. Because it sounds like I'm trolling. And at some level, it's like legit bait. It's trolling a little bit in a sense, but it's legitimate. It's like, we have now a phenotype that we're studying and a model around it where I can predict and be right that I can actually use cookies to lower cholesterol. Now, do you want to just shrug that off as like, this is a weird outlier, or do you want to kind of understand why this occurs? And I think anybody curious wants to understand, well, why is this happening?
Yeah, I think that's a great summary. And I do think that the proposed mechanisms make a lot of sense. Listeners of the podcast, obviously, we've talked about how for the average American, saturated fat, even often more so than cholesterol, via the LDL receptor drives LDL and ApoB up. And also for those listening, we've talked about LP little a and also ApoE genotypes before. Yes, those things will be characterized like through the future literature or whatnot. I'm sure as somebody who's kind of like independent and also curious of how those things would affect both neurologic and cardiovascular outcomes. So
yeah, I'll just emphasize, I think the point that gets confused is when I say like BMI dominates over saturated fat, it gets conflated with the statement saturated fat doesn't affect lean mass hyperresponders. That's not the case. Yep. But we're talking orders of magnitude here. So eating butter is not going to get your LDL to 500. It's just not going to do it. It might bump it a little bit, but we are talking about like serious different orders of magnitude here. So yeah, no, for the average person and for lean mass hyperresponders, saturated fat versus unsaturated will raise your LDL, as you said, via downregulation of the LDL receptor. But that doesn't explain the phenotype we're seeing here. It doesn't mean saturated fat doesn't affect lean mass hyperresponders. It just means it's not a dominant factor.
Yeah. Instructions unclear. I'm going to just consume as much saturated fat as I possibly can. just kidding there. I guess, given that we're talking about, you know, this phenotype or whatnot, I know we have listeners that would meet this phenotype. It occurred to me, if everybody in this country was put on a ketogenic diet and they could adhere to it, this is just hypothetical, of course, what percent do you think would be lean mass hyperresponders?
Well, I think a low percent because most people aren't that lean. I think the average body fat percent, you probably have these numbers better than I do, but I think for an American male is around 30% body fat, woman 40%. Most people aren't lean. 70-ish percent are overweight. So I don't think most would developed the LMHR phenotype. And just for a little bit more context, when we did the meta-analysis of randomized control trials, what we found is an inverse relationship between BMI and LDL change, but whereby people in the middle, actually, so overweight and class 1 obesity, when they go low carb, no change in LDL. When people with a normal BMI, so a normal, not actually population norm, but under 25, they see the LDL increases. And people with class 2 obesity actually see LDL decreases. So, you know, depending on your start point, I, you know, would expect different things. But if you ask the different question, how many very lean athletic people would convert to the lean mass hyperresponder phenotype? That's in the realm of speculation. I'm going to guess over 50%. This is something we've wanted to do, me, Dave, and Adrian, for a while, which is called what we call the gym hypothesis, because we think that if we went to a gym, we could just on site look at, like, I want to pick that person and that person and that person and that person, and I want to control their diets for 6 weeks, and we want to see how many we can convert. And I think I could just look at certain people and determine whether or not I could turn them into a lean mass hyperresponder by controlling their diet. And I think I could probably be successful with over 50% of cases, probably over 75%. But again, this brings up a nuanced topic. Like, a lot of these things, they sound like black or white. Like, I'm saying this is completely metabolic in a response versus this is, you know, a genetic phenotype. You could have permissive genetics. You could have, like, a, you know, a set of genetic foundation that is required for the metabolic phenotype to manifest, which is why I don't say 100%. Because I can't possibly know. I don't know, you know, all 20,000 human genes and their annotation and function. So it would be arrogant to me to say 100%. But just based on what I've seen, I would guess over 50, over 75% of lean people, if you could put them on a truly ketogenic diet for a little while. But that remains to be determined. So this is all still within the realm of me guessing.
Interesting. If there's anybody out there who has tried a ketogenic diet that has not been a lean mass hyperresponder, maybe we should just call it a lean mass normal physiologic responder if it's more than 50% of people. Let us know in the comments. And I guess by definition, the lean would be less than about 15% for males on a DEXA. So between about 5 to 12% on bioimpedance tests. Pretty common to see in bodies and whatnot come back 5 to 10% lower than DEXAs for males, and probably less than about 23, maybe 25%, probably less than 23% for females. If not a bit leaner on DEXA. But definitely would have to be lean, I agree.
I've seen very few people who are actually very lean and actually very low carb. Sometimes people say they're low carb and then you find out that they're just eating sweet potatoes. But I mean, I'm sure an example exists and I'd want to know what is special about that person. Also, you brought up the idea, you mentioned some lean thresholds, and this question always comes up. So I'm just going to attack it prophylactically, which is, if you look at our literature, we use BMI cutoffs.
Yep.
And it's not because BMI is that good. People always bring up, oh, what about people who are very muscular and lean? You're right. It's just a matter of the data that are available right now to analyze. So if we do a meta-analysis of 41 RCTs, they have not done DEXAs, you know, at every time point in each of these studies. So we're limited by the data that are available. For population studies, BMI is actually pretty good, but there are certainly exceptions. Very muscular people with BMIs of 29, but very low body fat, that might manifest as lean mass hyperresponders. And vice versa, people with a BMI of 23 who are a little bit toefy. So, you know, there are people that break the rule for sure.
Yeah, definitely agree. Everyone in this podcast realm is probably a body composition tracking enthusiast, but that's always good to keep in mind with the BMI. So that kind of brings the question, you mentioned people think they're kind of low carb. What would you consider low carb? Is there a specific cutoff, you know, like 30 grams, 50 grams?
You know, we as humans love to categorize and create criteria and thresholds. The fact of the matter is, biology and physiology doesn't give a crap about the cutoffs we generate, you know? So what I would say is that standard in the literature for quote low carb is less than 130 grams per day of net carbs, or less than 20% of your kilocalories from carbs. And then a ketogenic diet's typically defined various ways, but maybe less than 10% of energy from carbs, or less than 25 grams of carbs per day, or if you demonstrate nutritional ketosis. Point being, there are lots of different ways to define it. And then also, on an individual level, with respect to the physiology, it's really relative. Yep. So 100 grams of carbs for me is not the same as 100 grams of carbs for Sean Baker, who's 6'5" and 260 pounds. If you can't see me, I'm literally half the man he is, in terms of just pure body mass. So like, how muscular are you? How much activity are you doing? If you're an ultra runner and you're eating, you know, 80, 100 grams of carbs, that could be keto, but it's not going to be keto if you're sedentary. So yep. All these things need to be taken in context. You can put cutoffs for the sake of categorizing things in the literature because you kind of need to. Say you're going to group studies and do a meta-analysis. You do need a standardization. But on an individual level, it's really ask the question, you know, what is your use case? And, you know, what are all the other factors that would influence the impact of those carbs on your physiology? Are you very big and muscular and active or not? What is your overall energy intake? Those kind of questions. So sorry for a kind of hand-wavy answer, but that's the honest answer.
Yeah, that's a great answer. And that's what I've seen with my phenotype as well. Extremely active, crossfitting and functional fitnessing my life away. And I probably weigh between 230 and 240 most of the time. So if I partition my carbohydrates right, I don't think my fasting insulin's ever been above 3. And regardless of what I do, even when I do have, you know, a couple hundred grams of carbohydrates, my CGM data does not react how it would if you gave that diet to the average American. That's a point for individualized medicine, I guess. So I guess we've kind of talked about some reasons for low-carb or ketogenic diets. What would you consider other good reasons for low-carb or ketogenic diets, other not as good reasons, and then perhaps some contraindications?
Yeah. I would say there are a lot of good reasons for trying a low-carb and ketogenic diet. I think that there is unique benefits, or let's say enhanced over other interventions benefits for diabetes and obesity. You do get a metabolic advantage from a ketogenic diet in terms of weight loss, even beyond appetite control. But a point that I always like to make is that a ketogenic diet or a low-carb diet is not a weight loss diet per se. You can use these diets for, you know, even if there aren't RCTs, inflammatory bowel disease. There's now emerging literature for not just epilepsy, which was the ketogenic diet's initial main use case, but now other neurological diseases, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease. There was just a big trial, you probably saw it circulating around Twitter out of Stanford, on ketogenic diet for schizophrenia and bipolar.
Yep.
That came out of Shibani Sethi et al.
Even benign brain tumors. My understanding.
Yep, brain tumors in combination with like chemotherapy for things like glioblastoma, autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease. Hmm. There's so many things that now it's being explored for. So, a wide array of things. I think in terms of contraindications, I mean, it mostly would be if you have a particular genetic mutation that would cause you to react adversely to a high-fat diet, or if serious adverse consequences develop. There are, you can just look them up, I don't have them memorized, but just particular polymorphisms that are relative contraindications to ketogenic diets. I wouldn't say there's an absolute contraindication for being in ketosis, let's just say. But if you have a fat processing defect, you know, then you probably shouldn't eat, you know, a ketogenic diet. But it's like this for any food. Like if you have alpha gal, you know, let's say you get bitten by a lone star tick and have alpha gal, you probably shouldn't eat meat. But that's kind of like a rare thing. So there's not a ton of absolute contraindications in terms of just like, yeah.
I know this is also kind of debated. What about for example, type 1 diabetics or type 1.5 diabetics?
Andrew Kutnick would be the guy to talk to about that, but I think that they're now doing research specifically on that and finding efficacy. I mean, by definition, if you have type 1 diabetes, you're not generating insulin or you're generating very little. So it's not going to be the kind of thing that would very easily get you off insulin, but it could have benefits. It might have something to do with reducing, an autoimmune reaction. I think the main, from my understanding, the main benefits would come if you adopted very early on in the disease process, because maybe you still have some beta cell reserve. There are other things that might be going on that we don't necessarily fully understand well, or maybe I don't fully understand well, maybe it's understood, but say with glucagon inhibition. So in type 1 diabetes, because you lose the beta cells, and the beta cells are next to the alpha cells, which make glucagon, then there's a lot of glucagon release and low carb diets. I don't know what, I'm pretty sure in type 1 circumstances as well, though, they'd reduce or they'd increase GLP-1 area under the curve and inhibit glucagon. I know that there are other things that they've looked at to attenuate the glucagon response. But yeah, there definitely are some data on it helping type 1. Type 1 is not a contraindication, let me put it that way. And I definitely know type 1s. Now we're back in the realm of anecdotes, but like who go keto, and there might even be literature on this too, but like not only are they more stable, but they're having fewer hypos. So the concern would be, just on the surface of it, type 1, they're not eating carbs, therefore they're going to go hypoglycemic. And that's obviously a big concern for type 1s. I think that actually that tends to happen less and less as type 1s get fat adapted. But you'd have to talk to someone with expertise in that area, because I definitely don't want to misspeak on this, and definitely don't want anybody listening with type 1 to take this as, oh, Nick says I don't need carbs, let me just go keto immediately. That would be a disease condition where you definitely would want a lot of support in transitioning, because your body may react adversely at first if you don't do it the right way. As some people don't do keto the right way, they're like, ah, they get the keto flu, their electrolytes are out of balance, they get a little headache. You don't want to screw around with your blood sugar too much if you have type 1.
The how I started thinking about that is thinking about type 1 diabetics that are very proactive with their health, and also thinking about an endocrinologist, which I previously referred to. But now I've gotten a couple of his patients that have been in DKA. But long story short, if you take an SGLT2 inhibitor, which makes you pee out glucose, if you're a type 1 diabetic, then it is important to monitor urinary ketones, because there's a risk of something called euglycemic DKA,
Ischemic
or
DKA.
euglycemic diabetic ketoacidosis. And ketogenic diets probably do not increase the risk of euglycemic diabetic ketoacidosis significantly. But like you mentioned, many scientists and clinicians are studying that. So perhaps that's another podcast we'll have in the future. I know we've had one specifically on type 1 diabetes that Cameron can link in the description for anybody that happens to have type 1 or have family and friends with type 1 diabetes. But yeah, if anything, the downside might be if you're doing urine ketone strips in order to, because a lot of people, if they test a positive urine ketone strip, they'll stop their SGLT2. So that's something to potentially consider. But yeah, talk with your doctor or endocrinologist about that, but to make sure he or she is well versed in kind of like additional therapies for type ones. Bigger thing on the future for type ones, not to completely rabbit trail, is the long-acting amylin analogs.
There's a lot of innovations in this space. I've only heard of euglycemic DKA with SGLT2s, because you have
That's
like
the
an insufficient insulin response. I've never heard of it with a ketogenic diet.
only patients I've ever seen with euglycemic DKA is patients on SGLT2s every single day, and they're all from the same physician, which I talked to, and he said, "Oh, it doesn't happen." I don't have my patients check ketone strips. So famous last words, I guess. But and it's another sign that even if you're a specialist, you should continue being a lifelong learner. So but yeah, sorry for those that were a bit bored during that rabbit trail. I think that's probably a good place to wrap up for today. We'll have to do lots of future talks though.
For sure.
Yep. For those interested, where can people find you and where's the best place to connect?
Yeah. You can find me on Twitter at Nick Norwitz, and you can find me now on YouTube also Nick Norwitz. There are no other Nick Norwitzes in the world that I'm aware of, so I'm not a hard guy to find name-wise, last name N-O-R-W-I-T-Z. And to connect, I'm probably most responsive to my YouTube comments now because I'm transitioning to putting a little bit more effort into that. It's kind of fun to learn about. So anytime I put out a new video for the first like 2 days, I'm combing the YouTube comments pretty hard, and it's been really fun to interact with people there. So yeah, if you enjoyed this conversation or would like to learn a little bit more, you can try to find me there or on Twitter. I'd be happy
Perfect.
To connect.
Yeah, you can go and subscribe to his channel and comment, help the algorithm. But as always, thank you for your time and thank you for listening.
Thanks, Kyle.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.